This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
What does the future hold for electric vehicles? How big a part could they play in the transition to net zero emissions? And why is lithium, more than any other metal, found itself at the centre of the EV revolution? I'm Harry, a content manager here at LGIM, and today I'm joined by Michael Stewart, LGIM's head of pooled index strategy, and ETF analyst Elisa Piscopiello. They've just released a fascinating white paper that explores the role of the battery value chain within the energy transition and explains the path of lithium from the sourcing of this essential raw material through its use in batteries to the present and future battery applications in electric vehicles. You can read about this comprehensive journey along the battery value chain in the white paper, which is called The Battery Value Chain: How Batteries and Lithium Are Powering the Energy Transition. First of all, I'd be keen to find out from you guys why you've decided to focus on the battery value chain specifically in this latest piece of research, and why it's such a hot topic right now.
Perfect. Well, first off, thanks for having us, Harry. And yes, batteries are indeed a hot topic. They are literally everywhere. And the developments that we're seeing all along the value chain are, as you said, they're fascinating. And this is a market that is developing at a really interesting and innovative way, and a really rapid pace at the same time. And we would, of course, also view batteries as one of the key solutions helping to fight climate change over the next few years. And this is clearly another key driver of interest in the market kind of more broadly. Now, in the white paper, as you say, we focused on EVs because transport is a sector that accounted for about 1/5 of global CO2 emissions last year. So it's clearly critical. And electrifying transport would therefore have a significant impact when trying to reduce carbon emissions. Solving this issue is so important that governments and private entities are setting up goals and targets to really take us as you know, citizens and as the economy to a stage where emissions from transport will be massively reduced. Now, I think most of us are familiar with EVs and certainly notice an increasing adoption rate, especially in developed countries. I'm thinking about the roads here outside our office in central London. You're seeing more and more EVs on the roads. And Harry, honestly, in the past 2 weeks myself, I've just got an EV. So I'm now part of that club, having a great time. And I think clearly the trajectory here for EVs is really what we would call an S-curve. Just to give a few stats to help kind of make the case here. In 2022, over 10 million EVs were sold worldwide. So that's just last year. This year, we're expected to hit over 14 million EVs. That's a 40% growth rate just in 1 year. And if we look forward a bit further, 10 years down the line, we're expecting over 33 times more EVs on the road in 2032 than we had last year in 2022. So this growth is exponential. And these are really just amazing figures that show the growth in this market. Now, of course, there are many factors driving this growth. Of course, cost, accessibility, the ease of purchasing an EV. But of course, governments around the world are also pushing towards a higher adoption rate. The potential to reduce carbon emissions really explains these commitments and explains the push that we've seen in markets to push out and really to replace internal combustion engines in new vehicles. For the US, by example, is pushing for about 50% EV sales by 2030. The European Commission on their side is looking to end the sale of CO2 emitting cars by 2035. And here in the UK, we've even gone a bit further, looking to ban the sale of petrol cars by 2030. That's only 7 years away. So this is going to happen very rapidly. These are very strong commitments. And of course, meanwhile, car manufacturers are quickly kind of retooling, updating their offering. And so we're seeing this across the board, more and more car manufacturers offering, if not just a suite of EVs, but also planning to actually switch entirely to electric vehicles here in the near future.
Thanks, Michael, and congratulations on your new car. For anyone else who's had the pleasure of stepping into one, you might have experienced the sophisticated technology that's inside these modern vehicles. But let's dig a bit deeper, because I understand that conventional cars and EVs are very different in terms of the materials that are needed to build them. Ellie, could you give us some colour on that front?
Hi, Harry. Sure. Electric vehicles are certainly very different from conventional cars. And this is not only from the technology aspect or the sleek design, but other features as well, such as materials. So looking at what goes into these cars. EVs, in fact, have both a greater upfront requirement for mineral inputs, and they also need a wider range of minerals. And just to give you a feel of what this ratio, this comparison looks like between electric vehicles and normal standard conventional cars, an average EV requires 6 times the overall mineral input of a regular car. And we can split input materials into 3 broad groups. There are materials needed in similar quantities for conventional cars and EVs. The second group would encompass those materials needed for both types of cars, but that are needed in greater quantities for EVs. And then in the last group, we would find minerals needed exclusively for electric cars. Let's start from the first group. So those materials needed in similar quantities. This group is pretty standard. So steel and aluminium, these are materials that are needed in similar quantities for both conventional cars and EVs, and they're used for those components that are quite similar in both cars, such as the chassis and other structural components. Let's now move on to the second group. So those materials needed by both types of cars. Copper and manganese are examples of minerals that are needed in both cars, but more in EVs. EVs have a greater need for the conductive properties of materials like copper, requiring more than twice the amount of the metal on average compared to a standard car. An EV can contain more than a mile of copper wire just inside the stator, if you want an interesting stat, which is used to turn the electrical energy into mechanical energy. And you can imagine how much copper this car needs. So with a copper wire that is 1 mile long, you could cover 3 to 4 rotations on the London Eye. And this is just the length of this copper wire inside the stator of the car. Finally, last but not least, is the third group of materials. And this is the one that we've been closely looking at, because EVs open the requirement to have many minerals that until a few years ago were not needed. Graphite, nickel, cobalt, lithium, and rare earths are examples of these minerals. In our white paper, we have focused on lithium because with its characteristics, it is an ideal metal for batteries for EVs.
Thanks, Ellie. That's a great overview of metals and their role in cars, both the conventional kind and electric vehicles. I wonder if you can turn to the question of whether demand for these more unfamiliar minerals for EV production, has that affected the price of these commodities?
Yeah, Harry, and of course, we know that price is a function of demand. That's quite simple. And then therefore, as you would expect, lithium really has seen a rapid price escalation over the past 5 years or so. Looking at prices from 2017 through to 2022, lithium prices increased almost 7 times over this period. And that's compared to 3 times for nickel, 1.5 times for copper. And as Ellie just mentioned, those are also very important energy metals as well. So really, really interesting and strong growth in the price of lithium there. But there's more to this story as well, because it's also about supply. And the supply side is also unique, especially for lithium, because unlike other minerals, such as those needed to run maybe traditional vehicles, EV inputs are often much more geographically concentrated as well. So this adds another interesting dimension to the overall supply story for minerals such as lithium. Lithium, as you say, is particularly concentrated in a few different regions around the world. If you want to look at lithium-rich countries, you would generally look at countries in South America, but also I think Australia, China, and the US. This is really where we're seeing battery-grade lithium extraction take place.
Okay, so why don't we take a quick trip around the world to give us an overview of these lithium operations, how they work, and how the metal is brought to light, where it can be put into vehicles.
Happy to do so, Harry. As you know, I love to travel around the world, so why not do it now? Before we start our journey, though, there are 2 main ways to extract lithium that is important to keep in mind. Both of them are very complex because of a number of factors, such as various stages of permitting. testing activities before lithium is even extracted. But in both cases, lithium has to be extracted by below the surface of the earth. And this clearly involves a lot of work. So both types of extraction activities are extremely complex. So let's start our journey now. And if you picture yourself in South America, you might find yourself in a vast flat, a very large, sunny, very, very hot space. There is a place called the Lithium Triangle, which is between Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile. And this is where at least half of lithium in the world is believed to be located. And in these areas, it is located in brines. You might have come across beautiful pictures of vast salt flats, or even better, you might have visited places like the Salar de Uyuni in Bolivia. You can turn up and start drilling a hole and pump brine up to the surface. And as this brine comes to the surface, it starts evaporating in this very hot and sunny environment. And it is deposited into various ponds, and each pond has a higher and higher lithium concentration. As I said, these places are very hot, sunny, and this helps make brine move from one evaporation pond to the other, where mixes of minerals and materials such as manganese, potassium, borax, and salts are created while water evaporates in the sun, in this heat. But if you haven't started sweating yet in this heat, you might then want to move to Australia, where mining lithium is done with more conventional techniques. So mining, crushing, concentration, and separation methods that are more traditional than, brine evaporation. And in this area, such as Australia, lithium is found in spodumene-bearing pegmatites, which are intrusive rocks that are formed during the last phases of the crystallization of magma in countries like not only Australia, but also some parts of South America and other places in the world. And as magma cools, water and minerals become more concentrated. And this makes it possible to extract lithium. So hopefully I'll give you an idea of how complex extracting lithium from either brine or spodumene is with these examples. But it's not just a case of complexity. Timelines are also pretty long. And this is why we ask ourselves the question in the white paper, can we extract lithium quickly enough? How competitive is this market? In terms of timelines, lithium projects can take 8 to 15 years approximately to come online. Both main extraction processes of brine and spodumene, they require up to 4 years of project evaluation and feasibility studies. Then there are all the permitting phases, especially for those greenfield projects and those that are located in highly populated areas. And this phase of permitting can take over a year. And then all projects require mapping, surveying, drilling and testing before production can be scaled up and then stabilized and lithium can be regularly extracted. After all this happens, the extracted ore needs to be performance tested, needs to go through a quality assurance process, and then a packaging and storage process before it can be shipped, which adds to the cost and the complexity of this of the logistics process. This is a very long production cycle coupled with these complex logistics, and this creates significant barriers to entry in the lithium extraction market. And given how fundamental lithium is within the battery value chain, having such high barriers to entry is actually good news for battery grade lithium miners. This creates quite an attractive area of the market to be in, I would say.
So given the complexity that you've covered there in terms of extracting, processing lithium, its geographical concentration, why is it still a mainstay input for EVs? It sounds like there are good incentives to develop alternative battery chemistries, which might make use of other metals which are more readily available. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's a good question, Harry. And I think the first thing to remember is that lithium is very lightweight. And when we say very lightweight, what we actually mean there is that it is the lightest of all metals, right? If you look at the periodic table, it's number 3. So it really has a very unique place within kind of the mineral landscape. It's only about half the density of water. So in a glass of water, lithium would float because it really is that light. And yet at the same time, it combines this kind of lightweight properties with very, very high, what we call electrochemical potential. So this combination means it's likely to remain at least, you know, critical, or at least at the center, we think, to the EV story for many years to come. Now, of course, I know I say that, but markets are always pushing for innovation and looking to increase, you know, the life cycle of batteries, make them more dense, make them lighter, even longer lasting, quicker to recharge, all the things that as consumers we would want from an EV battery. And in this space, I think what we see is that what they call all solid state batteries, or ASSBs, just to throw another acronym out there, are really leading the charge to become the main contender over the next probably about 5 to 10 years from a commercial use perspective. And many manufacturers are therefore investing in this technology, this ASSB technology, to become kind of key leaders or kind of key innovators in this space. Now, the main difference with solid state batteries is kind of as the name suggests, the electrolyte in them is not liquid, as it is in current lithium ion batteries, but it's actually made up of a solid material, such as a ceramic or other materials. And this helps increase the density, increase the ability to hold more power, but also increases decreases the recharge time and makes it more easy to use as consumers. Now importantly for lithium miners, ASSBs tend to share the same chemistries as traditional lithium ion batteries. So in fact, solid state batteries can require up to 130% more lithium than traditional lithium batteries today. So more than double actually here. So we're talking about the same materials just being used in a slightly different way. Now looking further ahead, new chemistries for next generation batteries, such as maybe sodium ion is one we've heard a lot about. They may one day complement lithium as far as the minerals being used. But even with a rapid adoption in these other types of batteries, such as sodium ion, we really do see still a strong forward landscape for lithium demand. Some estimates that we're seeing are that lithium demand would increase fivefold over the next 5 years. And so definitely the market for lithium, we expect, will remain strong over the medium term. And definitely we expect that lithium will, at its core, remain critical to batteries for many, many years to come.
Thank you, Michael and Ellie, for that deep dive into the battery value chain and lithium. If this podcast has left you wanting to learn more about the topic, search for LGM Insights, where you'll find Michael and Ellie's white paper available to download.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.